Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
You are listening to You Look Hungry on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm broadcasting to you from the Big Easy. Today, I'm joined by Brian Bordanek of The Dinner Lab. Brian, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What is The Dinner Lab, and how did it get its start?
Dinner Lab is a membership-based private dining club that brings together people who are interested in food across different social scenes, ages, demographics, with up-and-coming chefs, and kind of gives them a platform to cook foods that they ultimately care about.
How did you get into food?
Well, I have zero experience in food, historically. And someone once told me, if you're going to start a business, you should start a business in something that you do better than other people. And for me, that was always eating, drinking, and bringing people together.
So, officially or unofficially, when did the Dinner Lab start?
The company was incorporated in July of 2011, but we kind of were trying to feel our way around the restaurant world. We knew, I didn't want to do anything in the traditional restaurant sense because of the fixed overhead and wasted food, wasted staff. It just seems like a really tough business. So we were trying to feel our way around and see, you know, how do we make a model in food, non-traditional work. So we started doing like pop-up dinners for people. We started doing private catering events, and none of that really felt right. So we kind of revamped the model and took on the private membership structure in August of 2012, so about 9-10 months ago.
Walk me through the experience of going to a Dinner Lab. What happens?
So first, it's a membership-based organization, so people find out about us mostly through word of mouth. We don't do press releases. We don't do SEO utilization or anything like that. We really look for kind of interesting people in cities, let them know about it, and then hope that our product is good enough that it spreads virally. So there's about over 1,000 members per location. So members opt in for a fee up front, which gives them access to the calendar. We post events every single Wednesday. Everything is done online. The purchase is done online so that, and the reason why we do that is we really want our diners to focus on doing what they do best, which is eating, drinking, and meeting other interesting people. So there's zero cash exchange at a Dinner Lab event, no gratuity. All of that is taken care of by us. So once the notification of the events goes out, people purchase their tickets in advance. They can see the menu. They can see a little brief bio on the chef, but they have no idea where the location is. And locations are sent out 24 hours in advance.
You have three cities currently. You have Austin, New Orleans, Nashville. Describe those cities as culinary cities. Like, how would you describe what's going on in the dining scene there?
All three cities. So they're all very unique. And I can sit here for hours and tell you about how each city is different from a culinary aspect. But what ties them through is that each city is like an emerging kind of city. It's got a lot going on, a really unique energy to it. And I think the food and dining scenes in those cities are reflective of that. I think you have a really strong young professional crowd, a really strong desire for new things. And I don't necessarily think that any of the three cities, from infrastructure and from like a true dining sense, has really caught up to the demand of where the cities are. I would argue that in both Nashville, Austin, and New Orleans, you have the same desire and hunger from a consumer perspective that you do in a New York City, in LA, or San Francisco. But I don't necessarily think that the dining scene has caught up. It's made, all of them have made strides, but it's so unique to have a hungry, quote-unquote, population in those cities. And now that you have like these restaurateurs doing really innovative things, people are trying to push the envelope, and we think we can both play a hand in that and kind of bring new ideas to the table and work with chefs and kind of expose people to new ideas. In a city like New Orleans, you know, there's not a 3 or 4 star sit-down Korean restaurant, right? So to be able to sit down and try out what upscale Korean food tastes like and feels like, I think it starts to get people to ask the questions like, why are there not a brick and mortar Korean restaurant here in New Orleans? Like, why does that not exist? And for us, we can say, well, not only do people love the food, but we also have the chef who can cook it really well.
Why do you think, you know, New Orleans doesn't really have an underground dining scene, so to speak, until you guys kind of came about? Why do you think that is?
You know, when we started the company, there was this thing, and I've talked about this with perception. I've talked about this with other restaurateurs here in the city, that it's not true. Let me just, like, first and foremost say this is 100% not true. But there's a perception that, like, any deviation off of Creole is going to not be received well. And when we were starting this, people were like, no way. No one's coming to eat Ethiopian food. No one's coming to eat food from the Basque region of Spain. Like, it's just not going to happen. Like, people in New Orleans like their Creole food, which we do. But there is a huge desire to ask questions like, what else is out there? And especially this city and Austin and Nashville are all cities that attract chefs, not just from, like, their local region. They're a culinary town in the cities from all over the world. So you have this really diverse group of people who are cooking foods that are not necessarily in line with what they love. So they're doing it anyway, right? The chefs are going home on Sunday when they're off, and they're cooking these amazing meals for their friends. So, like, selfishly, like, I wanted those meals. And I wasn't friends with chefs, so if I had to start a business to get access to it, that's what we did. But I think that there's a real, like, hang up on, you know, the traditional restaurant model, which is, like, you come, you know the menu, you come with the people that you know. But I think that this city and other cities, there's just a huge desire to do stuff a little bit differently. And restaurants are only about 250 years old anyway, but we just really assume them as part of being partly ingrained in our culture, which they are to a certain degree. But I think that there's huge room to do different things. And I just don't think that the reason why they don't exist, or, you know, and why our model doesn't exist really anywhere in the world, this is not that unique. You can literally go home tomorrow and you can replicate what we do. You can call a chef, you can call some friends, you can charge a membership fee. I think what separates us from the pack is that if you talk to anyone in the restaurant industry and you tell them that you're doing events two nights a week in different locations with different chefs, different menus every time, and different people, they'll be like, that sounds awful. Why are you doing that? I mean, it's a logistical nightmare what we do. And we've streamlined a lot of that process. But most chefs who do have a passion to do this, they wind up doing these things maybe once every 3 weeks, once a month, because the logistics of it are very, very, very difficult. And I just think that's the biggest barrier to entry about why these things don't exist all over the world. I mean, there are dining societies that have the same chef, and then they have the same location. But to change locations, to change chefs, I mean, think about this. A traditional restaurant, right, they have an owner who comes in and says, okay, what's our price point going to be? Let's do entrees between $15 and $25. What's the theme going to be? Let's do Mexican food. So once that is done and established, any special that they put on the menu is going to be, you know, maybe it'll jump up to $30, but it's not going to be $100, and it's not going to be $5. So when we change price points, when we change menus every single time, it's a creative process that is very difficult. And talk to any restaurateur and they're like, that is a really, the menu curation side is very hard. I do that 80 times a year per market. So every week we're constantly going through a creative process with a chef, and we've gotten really good at it. But it's a very difficult process to figure out price point, profit margins, and things like that, because we do have to sustain the business. And also working with chefs who are both insanely creative, and you're giving them a platform to do something different. So they want to put forth the best quality product that they can. But we have to make sure that you can plate it for 150 people or 80 people, whatever it may be. So I think the biggest barrier to entry is just that no one really wants to do it at scale, because it's really awful to do at scale.
The headache. Yeah. Well, so tell me about a past event in New Orleans. Like, give me an example of a chef and then the space and some of the issues that are kind of typical for you guys in terms of dealing with, we're in a warehouse, or, you know, some of the troubleshooting that you come across during the process.
Okay. That's a great question. One of my favorite meals that we've ever done was a sous chef from Coquette here in New Orleans. And he is part Cuban. So he works at a farm-to-table type restaurant, and we gave him the opportunity to do, he really wanted to try this out. He was like, he brought to the table the idea to do an entire pig roast, all parts of the pig. And we were like, all right, cool. Like, I mean, we very rarely will say no to something unless it just seems absolutely like our members won't want it. So we're like, all right, cool, we'll do an entire pig roast. We did it in a church that was deconsecrated and being remodeled into an event space, but it was under construction. So when we're planning out our calendar 2 months in advance, the owner of the space said, okay, we should have a window here for about a week. where the construction for the rafters will be done and the floor should be clear and you guys can squeeze in that week. And then the week of, he was like, by the way, construction got delayed and there's just like massive amounts of wood on the floor. And you're like, we need to do something about that. So we had to send our team in, help work with the building owner to help clear out the construction debris, set up the pews and set up the tables. And then we cooked an entire pig roast. We have to string lights wherever we go. We bring in generators sometimes. Sometimes we have to bring in restroom facilities, portable water. I mean, you name it. We like to look just like a chef approaches a menu with a creative sense. Our team on the ground in the city approaches space with a creative sense. And it's so funny to me to listen to people talk about the spaces because I think it's a huge aspect of what we do. And, you know, we'll go into a warehouse and people will be like, wow, this is beautiful. And it's so cool to me to see like a warehouse that was like, it's not like we fabricated this, right? Like, it's not like we spent millions of dollars to make it look like a warehouse, which I think a lot of like restaurants do nowadays. It's like when we leave here, like they're like right now during dinner, there are people like moving boxes to ship out. Like, and I think people appreciate the just really authentic nature of that, which is like, we didn't open a restaurant behind a speakeasy door that we built, right? Like, this is a functioning building that we're in, or this is an office being remodeled, or this is a church that's going to be remodeled. And I think people enjoy that exploration side of what we do, and it certainly presents really unique challenges about construction timelines, the power going out, and we've, you name it, we've dealt with it, and we tried to bake into our process a lot of things that help streamline that process. Generators are hugely important for us. General safety for people being able to rope off certain areas of a building that's under construction or what it may be. Finding an insurance agent to give us a $2 million liability insurance policy, like that took about 4 months to find someone that really understood what we were doing. So they're like, let me get this right. You guys are bringing in a group of people to eat dinner in a building, serving them booze, and the building is half finished. You're like, yeah. They're like, get out of my office. Like, we want like nothing to do with you. But I think, you know, for us, our members, you know, we'll send out emails that say, hey, don't wear heels tonight, right? Or it's going to be a little bit cold, or it may be a little bit hot, so plan ahead. And what's cool is that we're called Dinner Lab. We're not called dinner, right? So the people who come out to our experiences are really looking for a different kind of experience, right? People don't look at us and say, should I go to Dinner Lab or should I go to a traditional restaurant? People are coming for a different kind of experience. And I liken us more to a vacation than I do to the traditional dining experience. And I say that because if you think back to a time when you were on vacation, right, you may have been with a boyfriend or girlfriend or friend, you always bump into another group. And then there's that random dinner that happens when you're like with these random people who you just met, but you feel like you've known for years and you're eating food. Everything smells a little bit different, tastes a little bit different, right? And you can actually go back on that same trip and try to with the same friends, but it'll never be exactly the same. And that's what we try to do, which is this is not a networking event. And like one of the things that like people like to meet new people. And one of the biggest things that I wanted to look out for was I was like, I do not want people palm pressing business cards into one another. I want people to meet people like in an authentic way. And one of the happiest things in the way I describe it to people is that, you know, at a typical Dinner Lab, people aren't handing out business cards. They're taking their cell phone and putting each other's numbers in their phone. And that may seem like a very slight difference, but it's a huge difference. And I think people are making friends that they wouldn't otherwise have been in contact with. A 55-year-old is not going to traditionally think to go out to dinner with a 25-year-old unless it's his or her son. So for us to be able to use food as a common medium to pull people in, to take a Korean meal. You have someone who may have spent time studying abroad in Korea, sitting next to someone who loves Korean food, and there's a certain disarming that comes with that type of food. And we try to, our tables are typically one or two long tables that you're sitting next to people that you don't know, even if you do come with a date or a friend. And I think that it's extremely interesting to see people forming these like friendships that wouldn't otherwise be there. And the community aspect of what we do is just like, it's probably the thing I'm the most proud of as a business owner.
How would you describe the Dinner Lab diner? Who is that
person? Oh my God, I love this question because it's the hardest to answer. I started the company and I did not think that this was going to be true. I thought for sure everyone coming through the door was going to be 25 to 35. For sure. I had, like, all the hipster music playing, you know, like, I was like, we're ready for the hipsters, right? Like, park your obscure instrument over here and come and dine, right? And I started to see, certainly, we have a huge population of people that are, you know, about 40% of our demographic is in that range of 25 to 35. We have a significant portion of people over the age of 40 that come. And I started talking to them, and I was like, look, like, I'm dressed usually, like, in a V-neck and shorts and flip-flops. And I was like, tell me, like, why are you coming? And they're like, sweetheart, I've been eating with the same people for 30 years, and I'm so tired of it. I just want to meet other interesting people and explore kind of different things in food. And I was like, that's really cool. And that kind of cross demographic of age, I was like, okay, so when people were asking, who is your demo? I wanted to say 25 to 35 year olds, right? Like cool hipster kids, right? It's not necessarily true. So the way I describe the typical dinner lab diner is they're the early mover in a group of friends. They are the one in a group of friends that other people look to. They're the ones who go to the music festivals the first year and stop going the third year because it became cool. They are the type of person that when you're traveling to New York or San Francisco and you want to know where to eat, they're the person who gets that phone call. But that's not necessarily true of race. That's not necessarily true of income. That's not necessarily true of a lot of different things. But if you go to a dinner lab, that's the thing that ties them all together is that they are the early movers. And we've set up our entire business model around them and how they operate. So what's interesting, we asked our members to refer other members. Like, we're like, oh, cool. Like, let's let our members invite in a friend. And our members are like, I don't really want to invite my friends in. They're like, this is my thing, right? And by the time, like, my friends come in, like, I don't want to do it anymore. And we're like, okay, we need to be really respectful of that. So the way that we launch out in the market is very quietly. We don't do advertising or anything like that. The type of people that are attracted to us are the people who find us. They're the people who are looking for the new experience. But the second that we open up the floodgates and try to become, like, a guilt group, the people that we care about serving are the people who are like, I'm out of here, man. Like, I don't want to be a part of this anymore if everybody's doing it. And what's happened with Dinner Lab to date is that you have this group of people who are the early movers and their friends. You know how it goes. Like, think about replace Dinner Lab with a music festival, with a new clothing brand, with whatever. And they're like, how is it? And they're like, it's awesome. And they're like, oh, now I want to go. And then we set it up so that we have to protect our early members. So that's why we close off membership once we get to a certain point, and then we have a wait list, and we'll slowly leak out membership that way. But we're not a business that is, we're not going to cross over 2,000 people in any market. We just won't do it. The way that we grow is geographically, and we really want to be sensitive to our members that are coming to us because it's like an escape from the traditional. And they're willing to roll the dice with us. They're willing to go, oh, the power went out. Give us a minute until we get our generators, you know, back up and running. They're the people who are cool with that type of experience because they're seeking out something different, something out of the ordinary.
We're going to take a very quick break, but when we get back, lots more on the Dinner Lab. You're listening to You Look Hungry. Stay tuned.
This special program was brought to you by TechServe, New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and service provider, serving creative professionals at all levels, from individual customers to Fortune 100 companies. TechServe has built a solid reputation in their expertise in technology, sales, and service. Visit them on the web at techserve.com or in New York City at 119 West 23rd Street. Learn more about their in-store classes and incredible insider program. Make stuff happen. TechServe.
You are listening to You Look Hungry on the Heritage Radio Network. I am still your host, Helen Holliman. And if you're just tuning in, I am talking with Brian Bordanek of the Dinner Lab in New Orleans, Louisiana. And before the break, we were talking about what the Dinner Lab is, who goes to the Dinner Lab, and, you know, thinking on this topic of the ephemeral. You know, underground dining or just alternative dining experiences. You know, in places like New York, there are pop-up restaurants, partially maybe due to like real estate issues where it's an unused space. And then also just people who want something different. How do you feel for chefs, something like the Dinner Lab is helping them become better chefs?
This is something that I like literally get goosebumps talking about, because it's one of the things that I think is so important and so outdated about the current model. You have sous chefs, the number two, sauciers, chef de cuisines, chef de partie, at major restaurants that actually have the technical skill to be head chefs. But they can idle as a number two, three, or four forever. And if you're working at a restaurant like Aqua V or 11 Madison or Babo or something like that, and the head chef leaves, they very rarely will promote from within. They're going to find another big name to draw in. So getting into the major echelon category is very difficult. And then if you do get in there, you may not be cooking something that you actually care about. You're going to wind up doing a meal that another owner says that they should, that you should do. Or you can scrounge up your own cash and roll your own dice. So what we do is we come in and take these people who clearly have the technical skill to be head chefs anywhere. And we say, you come up with the menu. And most of the time they're like, wait, what do you mean? We're like, no. We just want you to cook something that's important to you and that is relatable. And they're like, well, I don't really know. Like, I had this, we used to do family meals back in Puerto Rico. We're like, perfect. I'm like, do that. And they come up with the menu. We work with them to make sure that things can be plated properly and things like that. And then what we do is we share the feedback with them. Our members will give feedback after every single meal. And then we share it with the chefs so that they can iterate their menu. As we grow as an organization, one of the things that I'm super excited about is that we can actually take chefs and put them on the road. So, you know, we're in three markets. You know, we're expanding as fast as we can while still ensuring that we're providing quality product. But call us at 8 markets. Give us a couple more months, right? I can take a chef from a restaurant, have them fly into New Orleans, cook a meal, prep it, get the feedback, scratch 2 menu items or iterate and improve 2 menu items based on the feedback from our members, fly them to Austin, do the same thing, scratch 1 menu item off, add this other thing, or, oh, let me just try this differently, get feedback, fly them to Nashville, do the same thing, fly them to another market, fly them to another market. By the time they get done, they've had feedback from close to 1,000 people who are the movers and shakers in food, who just care about the growth and development of a chef. And they have a menu that has been out in the universe and iterated on based on feedback on something that they actually care about. So what we can do at scale, which is what's really exciting about the future for us, is that as we get into 10, 20, 30 markets, we can actually look at how quickly events are selling out, the price point that people are interested in, and the menu feedback. And we can say, look, we know that Korean food is doing really well in Chicago. So we can actually partner our chefs with brick and mortar restaurateurs to say, don't open some random restaurant because you think it's a good idea. And like, everybody who is between 40 and 60 and has some disposable income wants to open a restaurant, which is cool. But if we can play a hand in saying, look, we know what food is doing well in the city, and I have a chef for you who is extremely talented, undiscovered, we can place him in there and mitigate some of the risk of starting a restaurant. And for us, if we can have any hand in disrupting the hiring process in the restaurant world, that's huge. And for me, I liken what's happening to chefs right now to sports athletes back in the 40s and 50s. And athletes in the 40s and 50s used to work jobs in the off season. And that's something that, like, you tell people today and they're like, that doesn't even make remote sense because they make so much money. But what you had happen then, you had, you know, management that treated their human capital with a certain regard, and you had an oversupply of this type of population. Right now, you have an oversupply of chefs. They just had a walkout at CIA a month ago. Students picked up and walked out of school and said, there's no way we're going to be able to pay back our student debt. And they're right. I was at an Applebee's in an airport 2 weeks ago, and I just asked to talk to the chef. Chef came out. We were just having a conversation. I said, where'd you go to school? CIA. The CIA-trained chef working at an Applebee's in an airport. And I'm just like, holy, you know, this is intense. This problem is actually, it's a problem. So what happens when you have an oversupply? You have chefs that are making $20,000 a year, $25,000 a year. They're cramming into apartments together to try to make it all work. So for us to be able to say, look, we're going to come in, we're going to work with the chef, we're going to pay them better than they're making at the restaurant for the time that we're working with them, and we're going to actually have them, give them the ability to cook the food that they love, and then give them feedback based on that food. We don't butter it up. We literally hit forward and send. And then we work with them to help them iterate that menu. So for us to be able to test new ideas with food, like if you think about a traditional restaurant, when they go, oh, no, 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 we can't put that on the menu, we can, and we will. And we say at a dinner lab, if we do a 7-course meal, you may not like all 7 courses. You should appreciate that it comes out hot, that it's portioned correctly, that it's aesthetically pleasing, but you may not actually love all 7 courses. And in fact, if you do, we're probably doing something wrong. And what we try to do is we try to offer a variety of different things in foods that they care about so that you can give that feedback to the chef. You get a new dining experience, you get to meet new people, you're in an interesting location in your city, and you're getting to experiment with a chef that wants to be more than they are. And I'm not trying to get like super meta right now, but I think there's something like very beautiful about the fact that you get to work with people who are aspiring to be something more than they currently are. And I have never met a sous chef in my entire life that wants to be a sous chef. They all want to be head chefs. They all want to, actually I know one, but they all want to be, for the most part, working, cooking something that they care about and are passionate about. But right now there's a disconnect. And if we can play any hand in that, and we're trying to get to scale because those are the things that really fire me up, providing an amazing customer experience and guest experience. And as a byproduct of that, you know, it's not like we're producing methane gas, right? And releasing it to the atmosphere. The byproduct of that is valuable information for a chef to better their lives. And that's something that is extremely exciting to me. And I say to our team all the time, and it's one of our company values that like, we are part of the fortunate few that get to make their living off of bringing amazing people together to eat. And we should always consider ourselves that lucky. And I think it's certainly, it's one of the things that we say all the time as an organization.
Okay, dream space, dream chef, dream food. Where, what would it be?
Oh, gosh. Oh, man, this is ridiculous. That's a tough one. Okay, dream space. I prefer our like raw-er spaces, right? Which may make some of our members a little bit more uncomfortable, but I love the spaces that, like our chefs, are aspiring to be something that they're not quite currently. And as entrepreneurs, that resonates with me. We're all aspiring to not be broke, right? And I think a space that I love, old churches that are being remodeled and old buildings that are slightly, let's call it an old building, really banged up outside, but a interior that like you can see that like you can see the dream of the person who is opening this space or remodeling the space. It has like hints of absolute beauty. It's raw. The dinner would be like an 80-person dinner. I would say like 7 courses. For me, I am a big fan of Asian food. So I think Korean. Southern Korean food, like just really amazing family style. I joke about this. I work in the food business and I joke that I don't have bad table manners, but like I always hate the little sharing plate. You know, when you have something that could serve family style and then people scoop out of the family style plate and then they dump it in their tiny little plate and then they eat it. Like I love when you're close with people and you go out to a dinner that like you have the family style plate. There's like plates being passed all around, everyone's picking off the plates, and then there's like wine flowing everywhere. That is that's how I spend my free time, and that's how I get to spend my business time too. So that's it's really, really, really fortunate. But for me, 7 courses, like at least 5 of them family style, being passed around, at least 4 of the people around me I don't know, at least 1 of them I do, and just having that like commonality with them. And that kind of magic that gets created with sitting with the right people at the right time in the right place and eating the right food.
Well, we both live in New Orleans. Tell me about an ideal day for you in terms of where you would eat and drink.
So I organize these. Before Dinner Lab started, I used to organize my birthdays. I used to send out an itinerary. And I used to say, dear friends, I love you all. Here's my plan for the day. Come and stop in when you can. And my friends come from, I have friends with techies and friends with entrepreneurs and friends with, I'm a former teacher, so I have a lot of people in education. I've done a lot of community service stuff here in the city, so I have a lot of friends in community service. So my friends are like all over the map. And I usually use my birthdays to like catalyze those groups and bring them together over food. And when you look back, it's like totally linear, like, oh, that makes sense how you wound up doing this. So for me, I would start. I'm going to give you a full itinerary. I hope you're ready for it.
Yeah.
I would start at Cafe Envie, A, because they have a bar, and B, because I love their breakfast there. The wraps there are just absolutely fantastic. I would move from there to Molly's. Right? I live in the French Quarter, so a lot of these are going to be French Quarter related. From Molly's, I'd hang out there for a little bit. I'd go to Coop's for lunch, because it's not crowded during lunch. Some great fried chicken there. From Coop's, I would bounce over to Sylvain for a second lunch, which Sylvain is one of my favorite restaurants here in the city of New Orleans. From Sylvain, and they make the best Sazerac in the city, in my opinion. From Sylvain to French 75, just because I love the bar in there. It feels like you like went back in time. From French 75, I would probably wind up doing an oyster happy hour somewhere. Probably Felix's, which I love. From Felix's, I'd start to make my way uptown and head to Lillette is one of my favorite restaurants in the city. So I would love to get like a bottle of wine, sit at the bar, get a bunch of appetizers. And then from Lillette, probably to Dante's for dinner, followed by late night dessert, maybe at like Boulogne Tavern. And then I would probably, I say that, I've done this, like what I've described to you has been done. And it was one of the best and worst days of my life because I had one friend who stayed with me the entire time. There was also a 2-hour nap baked in there because otherwise like I would have died. But I called it like, I think it was called like Brian's Gluttony or like Brian's Hedonist Food Fest or something like that. And it was such a great day for me in the city because, and that's extreme. If you did that every day, you would actually die. But for me, it was so cool to have like these little pit stops that were like short. But the people that came by, like, all wanted to be there. They came by because they either wanted to see me or they really liked the spot or probably some combination thereof. And it was so cool to have my friends that are from different groups that didn't necessarily know each other, but sharing a bottle of wine or sharing a cocktail and, like, just funny stories and meeting each other. And I think from my birthday, like, my friend group became totally integrated. Like, they all started hanging out with one another, and I was like, that was where a real bug I put in my ear where I was like, oh man, like I think one of the coolest things that Dinner Lab does that I love and I've done my entire life is bringing together people who you know are going to be friends, but they don't know that they want to be friends with each other yet. And for me, I always done that with people around my age group, but what's so cool for me about Dinner Lab is that I get to see that from 25-year-olds and 55-year-olds. I'll tell you a quick anecdotal story and then I'll stop ranting. I was outside of a dinner. Sometimes we have people who help with parking at dinners, and I was talking with one of the attendants out there. And I saw, as the dinner was wrapping up, I saw a young 25-year-old African-American couple walk out. And then right behind them, like, it must have been like a 55-60-year-old white couple walked out right behind them. And the husband walked away, and he was going to get a car. And I saw them getting into a car together, and I was like, where are y'all going? They're like, we're going to get a beer. Like, we're going to continue our conversation from dinner. And I was like, awesome. Like, I love that. And if we do nothing else but that, like, I can hang my hat on that. I'd be all right.
What is on the horizon for the Dinner Lab in the future?
Well, for us, we're building out our infrastructure, really shoring up our internal stuff as well to make sure that all of our technological systems are in place to be able to hit scale. We're going to continue in the markets that we're in. We have found that people have been really receptive to this. And like I said before, we really tap out at about 1,500, 2,000 members a market. We want to always be small. But in order for us to sustain a business, we move geographically. So there are a bunch of other places, both domestically and internationally, that we are planning to go to in relatively short order. So we hope we're in 3 markets right now. We hope to be in 6 in the next couple months, and then see what that feels like, make sure that the product is still amazing. We're going to overshoot it in the sense that like we're probably going to hire a few more people to make sure that things are going well. I would just rather be in a situation 6 months from now where I said, well, we probably could have done without that extra person or two, from a management perspective, rather than saying, oh man, I really wish we had one or two more managers to make sure things are going well. Because at the end of the day, we provide an amazing customer experience, and any deviation off of that is not good. So we have to make sure that that is always 100% true. That's our members are everything that we are, and we have to treat them like gold. Otherwise, like, we are nothing, right? And one of the best things that we love our idea, we think it's cool. One of my favorite business quotes of all time is that your idea sucks, listen to your users or you will have none. And we are huge proponents of that. We call our users randomly and just say, like, hey, if you would be willing to give, like, 10 minutes of feedback, we check in. We want to make sure the feedback is being listened to. One of the dinners recently, it was super hot. We didn't think it was going to be as hot as it was. It was, like, 1,000 degrees during the day. And I remember being like, wow, this was hotter than I expected. So we sent out an email to all of our members and said, send us your dry cleaning bill. Like, mail us it. We'll mail it right back to you. Like, we're sorry. We always want to provide an amazing experience for you. We're a startup company. We're going to mess up every now and then. And we're a startup company that's, like, trying to find random locations and do all this crazy stuff. But we want to make sure that we're taking care of you first. And whenever that's not true, we're going to own it. And we're going to make it right. So that for us, in terms of the future, we're going to grow. We're going to be in a couple cool markets relatively soon.
Well, Brian, thanks so much for coming on the show. And yeah, for more information, you can go on thedinnerlab.com.
Yep, it's just dinnerlab.com. And you can check out the current cities that we're operating in. We're not trying to be too cool, but we don't put too much information on our website. But you can sign up if you're in a city outside of the ones that we're currently in. And if you want more information about a city that we're in, you can certainly sign up for a membership or a wait list, depending on the city. But you got to come out to a dinner.
Oh, I shall.
Very cool.
Well, as always, thanks so much to Joe Galarraga, Jack Inslee, and the rest of the crew at Heritage Radio Network. I'll see y'all next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.